From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made just a few weeks before the Iowa caucuses around Christmas in 2007. On the Democratic presidential side, the caucuses looked like a three-way dead heat, and John Edwards' team was privately conceding that he had to win to have a chance at the nomination. Hillary Clinton had long been considered a favorite, but the race had narrowed, and on that day, after months of campaigning in Iowa, Michelle Obama admitted to the New Republic, quote, "If Barack doesn't win Iowa, it's just a dream," end quote. Could that really be true? After all, even in a hotly contested presidential year, only about 15% of registered Iowans attend the caucuses. It's a small state to begin with. A candidate who wants to be president is going to allow 15% of eligible voters in one of the smaller states in the country and in what is one of the least diverse places on earth to decide whether he can keep running? Well, yes. In fact, Obama's campaign manager, David Plouffe, told the New Republic, quote, "Iowa is the whole shebang. I guess I'm not supposed to say that," end quote. Well, we appreciate the honesty, David. And we know that Barack Obama went on to win the Iowa caucuses with 38% of the final tally. That means that a few thousand Iowans served as the deciding margin for whether the next president would even try to become the next president. How did we get here? Why is Iowa always first? Why is New Hampshire always the first primary? Why can't we rotate the process and allow more voters to feel included in the selection process? How would it impact voters, and especially young voters here? And how does the obsession with Iowa and New Hampshire impact policy, pandering, subsidy, and more? Ted Cruz has declared his candidacy for the presidency. You just heard on NPR a few minutes ago, Rand Paul declaring today, almost immediately, I should say, they went to Iowa. I should say they went back to Iowa. They've been there. Candidates effectively live in those two states. We're about to see more of that. But don't expect to see the presidential contenders offering speeches or public events in Western New York. Our panel will look at the impact of the system and whether there is a realistic hope of changing it. My guests for the hour include Kent Gardner, the chief economist for the Center for Governmental Research, and someone who has looked for a long time at ethanol, subsidies, and more. Nice to see you, Kent.
Nice to be here, Evan.
Tim Nealon is here. Tim's a political science professor at Nazareth College, and he is going to tell me to tone down the snark this hour, are you?
Yeah, probably, Evan. Probably.
Oh, please, no.
That's part of Tim's job today. Iman Abid is the president of Monroe County Young Democrats. Iman, nice to see you here.
Very excited to be here, Evan.
And Scott Onestak is University of Rochester College Republicans treasurer and business manager. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Tim Nealon, how did we get here? There's a very complex question there, but I guess in Iowa, at least 1972 is since then they've been going first?
Yeah, and it goes back to the 1968 Democratic National Convention where the new left and the old left clashed. It was a disaster because the party leaders had nominated Humphrey, who was not an anti-war candidate. So they created the McGovern-Fraser Commission. They came up with a plan that would lead to more primaries or caucuses to nominate the candidates for president. Now, Iowa, which had been just sort of sitting there, they had a caucus since 1846, but it was mostly for internal politics. They become, in 1976, with Jimmy Carter's second win victory there, I think he lost to none of the above, becomes That's a right. media sensation. And from that, he springboards from being a fairly unknown candidate to go on to win New Hampshire. So that's really where the dynamics begin. Once the media attention was there, the Republicans followed the Democrats in using these primaries and caucuses to raise awareness, to raise media attention to their candidates.
Okay. And so Iowa goes first as a caucus. New Hampshire actually has it codified in law that they are – they have to be the first primary?
They do. Both Iowa and New Hampshire have something in their laws that make them first in the nation. Now, that's the other thing you got to remember. Parties play a role in this, but state legislatures are the ones that determine when the primary caucus is. New York has traditionally been very late. We could go earlier if we wanted. You'd have to maybe give up some delegates and offend some Republican or Democratic leaders, but that would still make it more relevant for nominating a candidate.
Okay, and there's a lot to talk about, a lot of different angles here, but Kent Gardner, when we look at policy, is it an overstatement to say that with the process the way it is, there is a large emphasis on pandering to big ag? Is that an overstatement?
Not in the least. It's there's this marvelous episode in West Wing from 2005 where the two candidates show up all of the candidates show up in Iowa, and they're all asked to take the pledge. And, you know, in typical West Wing fashion, I think West Wing really likes to believe that everybody knows the score, and they do stupid things in public for reasons they must, you know. But all of the candidates say, oh, this is crazy. And, you know, I think it's Arnold Vinnick, the Republican candidate, declares it the mother of all panders. And also suggests that it should be a candidate for profiles and spinelessness.
Does that sink his campaign?
No, well, it does not sink his campaign. He actually stands
this
up.
Is fiction here.
This is fiction, yes, but played by Alan Alda. I mean, I'd vote for Alan Alda any day, but Arnold Vinnick stands up and declares that it's crazy, and then he gets out of town. So he does actually choose to not take the pledge, and he leaves town. The Jimmy Smits character, Matt Santos, is the Democratic candidate, actually does hold his nose and takes the pledge. Sees Vinnick a little bit later, and Vinnick says, well, I didn't know you were a supporter of ethanol. He says, well, I wasn't until today.
Well, we can laugh about that, but we are going to delve a little more seriously into the impact of policy. Kent's going to help us do that. By the way, Tim Nealon, there apparently are a number of proposals that would allow New York State, for example, everybody else to have a chance to go first that would rotate things.
Right.
There's a
Delaware plan and the American plan have both been proper.
But here's the amazing thing. See, I'm thinking when I'm reading this plan for the first time last night, I'm thinking, here's something that would actually rotate things. And you go back to, 1999, when the Secretaries of State Association put this plan together, divide the country into four quadrants, northeast, southeast, southwest, northwest, rotate which of those quadrants goes first. But somewhere along the line, Iowa and New Hampshire, I'm convinced they have incriminating photos of the rest of the country, and they said, you still have to have us first. So even if we do the quadrant rotating primaries, Iowa and New Hampshire would still be first.
And the Republicans in 2000 came up with a plan called the American Plan that also would have rotated. It would have been a very different plan. It would have been like states with eight or less congressional districts all the way up to 10 two-week cycles. But they also backed off because they were afraid the Democrats would not follow suit. So they would be picking their candidates as late as June. The Democrats might have their candidates already in March, and so they backed off of that. The other problem is the media attention. 25% perhaps of all media coverage in the nomination process is on Iowa or New Hampshire. No party wants to give up that free press. And then finally, there's the retail politics of it. Yeah, these are small states, but you really want to know if a person's going to make a mistake, they're going to lose it. They're going to lose it going door to door or eating, you know, cherry pie in a diner in New Hampshire or Iowa. And you have to get up close and personal with people that you don't have to do in these other states. Yeah, we have big states that have primaries and caucuses, but, you know, a lot of that's the air war. You get down to South Carolina or Nevada, they have a lot of TV-saturated ads. You can't get away with that exactly in Iowa or New Hampshire. So there's some benefits to this policy. And on ethanol, I kind of think there's a lot of states that grow corn. I think it's more than just Iowa. I think it's you know, Nebraska,
but that's not the
Kansas,
point, Tim.
Right.
I mean, you know, the point is that it's a dominant part of the Iowa economy.
But it's also part of Congress. Congress could change the law on ethanol subsidies.
Well, yes, but they don't because all the candidates took the pledge in Iowa, and they don't want to take a chance on losing. I mean, half of the Senate wants to run for president, for heaven's sake.
Well, that's true. But again, there's a lot of people in Illinois, Missouri. There's a lot of corn out. There's even corn in New York State. If you go out to where I live in Hamlin Hilton, there's corn out there.
Well, sure, but there are lots of commodities and certain parts of the economy that benefit from special subsidies.
Yes.
But the special subsidies that are provided through ethanol subsidies are particularly egregious.
They are.
And they wouldn't happen, and just because there are other states that grow corn, it wouldn't happen if we didn't have the Iowa caucuses. Absolutely. Single-handedly, that creates what has been probably one of the most damaging environmental policies of the last century.
All right. So, we're setting the stage for a fascinating hour here. And by the way, Tim mentioned 25% of the media coverage. That's the new estimate, that roughly 25% of all the media coverage for the primary process, start to finish, 50 states, is Iowa and New Hampshire. Richard Perloff is a political scientist who studied this 10 years ago and found Iowa and New Hampshire receive up as much as 50% as all of, essentially half of all of the media coverage is in two states. half of it. And how about this for disproportionate impact? William Mayer is a political science professor at Northeastern. He discovered, controlling for other factors statistically, a win in New Hampshire alone increases a candidate's share of the final primary count in all states by 27%. In Iowa, the voting turnout is low. We know 10 to 20%. In New Hampshire, they have a turnout of, you know, even in a good year, 51% in 2008, for example. We're talking a few hundred thousand voters impacting 1.6% of the population. That's the New Hampshire voters. 1.6% of all the American population are New Hampshire voters. They've got 27% of the power.
But the other issue, too, here is that we're talking about, and in Iowa, we're talking about the caucus. This isn't even a real primary, for heaven's sake.
But the caucus is fascinating. So they get together, and Democrats and Republicans do it differently. Republicans still use a secret ballot, and they write down their name, and then they're gone, and the Democrats are still talking. But they actually have this thing called viability. So they're actually talking to different groups. So you stand in a corner for John Edwards, you were mentioned before. Yep. Or you stand in a corner for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. And then if it doesn't look like you have enough people, you try to coax them into coming with you. So you got two things. You got preference, but then you also got the idea the Iowans are thinking, well, who can win? Which are two considerations that we know that voters take into mind. Who can win, but also who do I prefer?
So you're saying you're okay with it. You like it?
I actually think this is a reasonable approach because it's a sample size.
Only a political scientist would come to such
well,
a conclusion.
A lot of my colleagues would disagree. But if you look closely at what's happening on the ground there, I mean, if you are an underfunded candidate, Iowa and New Hampshire are your best bets. If we start out with, like, New York State and you were poor, good luck with that because you're not going to have the media, the transportation. Iowa and New Hampshire can help candidates who are not particularly well endowed move up, as you said. And nobody's gotten the nomination since 1976 who's come in under second in Iowa or New Hampshire. So they actually do have a really important role. But again, maybe that role is actually reflective of general patterns rather than dominating patterns.
Okay, well, here's what it's not reflective of, diversity of this country.
Right.
So let me ask Iman and Scott, as the young sort of the voters in your crowd, the people that you work with at Young Democrats, you hear this kind of debate. Most of the campaigns that you've worked on have been, look like state level to me, Iman. You've worked on half a dozen campaigns or so?
Yep.
Okay, and do you feel left out of this process, or how do you feel about what we're discussing here?
Well, when I first began, I definitely felt I felt like I was very far from the process, but that's why I kind of started to refocus my efforts and being able to get myself involved in more of the organizations, figuring out exactly what roles I could even potentially start to play in the campaigns and what could play the greatest influence. But that's something that I also, as I kept going up, I kind of started teaching other people and trying to get younger people involved and trying to get them engaged and mobilized. And I've been doing that for 4 or 5 years now and just trying to get involved in, you know, town organizations, county level organizations. And of course, now as being president of the Monroe County Young Democrats, we've been able to transform and get far more people mobilized. We're starting new chapters out on college campuses, making sure that people are engaged. I was just talking to Neil, a little bit before, and just saying that, you know, you have 18,000 students per se at RIT. Why aren't we using them? You know, why aren't we mobilizing them? Why aren't we getting them involved? And that's all a matter of a fact of getting people who are already involved in the political process and teaching others how they can be involved. So that's kind of the direction I'm trying to push in and, you know, engage people around the county.
To some degree, the fact that the presidential process kind of doesn't really exist here allows you to focus on those local and state races and maybe not be distracted.
I think right now, that's definitely for sure. But I think, of course, summer coming along and once the presidential candidates are starting to get chosen, we can almost begin to use that as a leverage and trying to get people, you know, very engaged, very involved in the political process, you know, showing them that, you know, we just kind of saw this trademark, making in history of seeing President Obama, of course, make it. Now, what's next? How can we get the next best thing? What are we going to do? And I think that goes along a lot with the Democratic ideology, of course, and just always trying to find, you know, who's the next best thing and whatnot.
Iowa and New Hampshire aren't listening. Do you have a problem with the process?
I do not. I mean, I feel like it's just a matter of restructuring what you have already and what we're capable of, especially as younger voters. You know, what are we capable of doing? How are we capable of getting involved in the political process? And that's very small right now and minuscule. But perhaps, you know, with a better understanding and trying to teach others how to get you know, more involved, that'll definitely help.
You were made for politics, Iman. That was a very good answer.
Scott
Onestak is with the Republicans and the University of Rochester and the campus Republicans there. Do you have a problem with the process as you see it?
I do have a problem with the process in the sense that Nate Silvers did a study on this, and he showed that if you win the Iowa caucus, you're most likely to get an increase on your New Hampshire polling by 7% when people go to the polls. So, and that varies widely, because he said even George Bush and John Kerry got 20% increases. So it's almost like this self-fulfilling prophecy that snowballs by the time it gets to New York or any other state, like a Super Tuesday. They say, I really don't care, because they've already chosen, or my guy isn't going to be the person anyway, so what's the point of me even going?
Well, let me ask you, as a Republican, as I watched that process play out almost 4 years ago, to 2012, I was in many ways impressed with a guy like John Huntsman. He had no traction in Iowa. I think he pulled at less than 1% there. And he put everything into New Hampshire. And I remember the saddest moment I've seen in politics was when John Huntsman stood on the stage and said, we came in third, and everybody cheered. It was this desperate attempt to, knowing that it was probably over. Over for a guy like that with 48 states to go. 48 states to go, and he knew it was over because of exactly what you just said, self-fulfilling prophecy. Does that bother you?
Yeah, I kind of feel like the other 48 states feel like they don't matter. Like, they look at it and they say, those two states have chosen it, and then people, they want to get on it, so they bandwagon and they say, I want to get in on with the candidate who looks like they're going to win. And so the other people, they just say, well, I mean, even look at Pennsylvania, Rick Santorum,
yeah.
He's very popular in Pennsylvania. He only got 18% of the vote. He was our state senator for two terms, and he couldn't even, Mitt Romney got over 50%. How could he not do that well in his own state?
But he lost his reelection to the Senate, so he couldn't have been that popular.
I mean, but
he did lose his...
Just pointing out the fact that Pennsylvania does lean Democrat.
Iman, you want to jump in?
I was just going to say, do you think that's a problem with the actual structure, the political structure, or is it more so just as you were saying, the media coverage? Like, it's more so like, hey, you know, you have a friend and they're choosing a place to eat, you're just going to go pick that place to eat just because they said so, and you're starting, you kind of use that other person's opinion as kind of to elevate yourself.
To the extent you say that, you know, people were just jumping on and saying, well, everybody liked this guy in Iowa, so I'm going to vote for the guy in Iowa, doesn't obviate the fact that Iowa is a really unusual state.
Right.
And, you know, I think the point that Evans made a couple of times is that you know, despite the virtues of retail politics, and I agree with you, Tim, that there's some really real advantages to retail politics in Iowa and in New Hampshire. Surely any kind of remotely objective process would circulate the small states at least. We would come up with a system that would be at least over time somewhat more representative than we have right now.
And Scott's nodding right along with you. Let's just briefly run down some of the numbers. If you want to look at Iowa, New Hampshire, and their disproportionate sway in the presidential election process, here you go. The United States is 77% white. When Hispanics describing themselves as white are included in that population, but when Hispanics describing themselves as white are included in the non-white population, the United States white population falls to 62. So 62 or 77% is the United States white population. In Iowa, 89 to 91% white. New Hampshire, 92 to 94% white. African Americans, largest minority in the country, 13.2% of the U.S. population. Iowa, 2.9% African American. New Hampshire, 1.1% African American. So, Tim Nealon, that is an argument that says that is not reflective of the diversity of our country.
Right, but voting is also not reflective. If you look at patterns of voting among different people groups in the United States, you'll find that there tends to be an undervote by people of color as well. I mean, so there's other factors that need to be engaged there beyond the fact that these
Which suggests
two,
that yeah. even more so, if you're going to a state that is particularly non-diverse, you're even more significantly disenfranchising people of color.
Perhaps on the other hand, though, again, since it's retail politics, people of color could have a greater impact on the outcome, since you've already pointed out that only about 15% are engaging in the caucus, which is open to everyone. Who, as long as they're going to be 18 on election day. So we have 17-year-olds who get to engage in the political process in Iowa. And again, they get to talk, and they get to talk up their candidates. So I don't think that actually negates the role that Iowa could play in creating greater diversity. I think that's an argument. On the face of it, it sounds, yeah, reasonable. Well, if we look at percentages, but again, voting is about the sample of the population size who comes out to actually cast their ballots. And so those numbers could be increased by Democratic activists or others who want to bring greater diversity to the caucuses. So again, we could use the existing system to increase the percentage and the outcome and create a greater diversity in the candidates. But that, again, you could do that in another way as well. But you know, if you've got a system that's in place, maybe there's ways to tinker with the system that exists rather than trying to start all over again.
But what about, I wonder to what extent the intensely retail character of the politics in Iowa and New Hampshire have to do with the size, and how much of it has to do with simply being first. I mean, how long do the candidates, everyone knows how important Iowa and New Hampshire are, and that's why they all show up there very early. I mean, if New York were the first primary, we would see candidates. We'd probably see them many, many times. It wouldn't maybe quite get to the level of retail that we see in Iowa or New Hampshire. But
no,
I don't think it would be.
It could. Yeah.
But nonetheless, if you've got 2 years to campaign in New York, and that's really the amount of time they're spending campaigning in Iowa and New Hampshire, we would certainly see a lot more of the candidates than we do now.
And it's not only Iowa and New Hampshire. If you're running for president, you're putting organizations on the ground.
Yeah, but the candidates don't show up there.
Well, but the
candidates are living in Iowa and New Hampshire.
The candidates make dozens and dozens of visits to Iowa and New Hampshire, but they don't. So if you remove them, they're gonna make dozens and dozens of visits to what? South Carolina,
some other
Nevada,
state,
to some other
while,
state.
Yeah.
So, but again, then the argument again, we have regionalism, and so
my argument would be we should be rotating them, and you know, it's not that you pick the perfectly representative state, but to have it the same two states every cotton picking presidential election.
You got to start somewhere, and
so let's change the starting point.
But again, why? For what outcome do we see? Again, political scientists look at a number of factors to indicate the importance of Iowa and New Hampshire. But again, we've already looked at the role that media might be playing in some of this.
We're partially to blame, yes.
and I didn't say that.
No,
very
I did.
Diplomatic.
It's fine. Absolutely.
But again, I don't see that, you know, I've seen some of these plans, and they would all like to start with the small states anyway. I mean, a lot of these plans start with much smaller states, retail politics, et cetera, et cetera. So you start with Wyoming. You know, the diversity factors there. I mean, many small states are very rural, and the diversity factor is not going to be there as much if you don't have these large urban environments. And so, you know, even if you're rotating, you don't want to start with the big states. No one wants to start with the big states because that would be a problem.
Why, though? I don't understand. It would be a problem in what way?
Finances. You would only have really wealthy candidates who would be able
to
capture.
Tim, I got to disagree with you because, you know, that presumes that we're already in the heat of the campaign, and the only way you get attention is by going over the airwaves. If you've got 2 years to campaign in New York, you can spend a lot of time in Rochester. You know, you can get to Potsdam, you can get up to Plattsburgh, you know, you can spend some time down in Cattaraugus County. You know, you really could cover the state if you had enough time and you were really serious about this particular state. It wouldn't have to be strictly an air war.
I've seen gubernatorial races in this state where somebody has gone and visited and visited and visited, but they don't have the money for the media buys, and it does not in the long run help their campaigns. We've had third-party candidates who don't do very well either. And we're talking retail politics. I mean, Howie Hawkins, I mean, he's everywhere all the time. And yet,
he's Howie Hawkins. Right.
But I'm just saying, if you look at minor party candidates or third-party candidates who often use that, well, I'm going to go door-to-door. I'm going to knock on every door. It still doesn't help if you're not well endowed financially. You've got to have those finances. And money is also support.
Then let me ask you, Iman, and let me ask the young leaders in the room here. When we talk about money in politics, a common question is whether we should change the system. You see Larry Lessig, Harvard Law professor, leading the charge for a public finance system. He calls it the most important cause in politics is changing the way the money is structured and the pay-to-play system. Iman, you're president of the Young Democrats. You agree?
I definitely think... I personally wish that money didn't play such an influence in it, especially just as a Democrat. Of course, it's very hard to get people engaged and to even to begin fundraising in most campaigns and whatnot. But even more so, it's through this revolution. I think someone was mentioning, I don't remember if it was Neil or Kent, but I think there's a revolution of grassroots campaigning, and which is actually not only adopted by third-party candidates. That's adopted by all candidates. I'm not too sure how many of you guys in the room actually focus in on, like, Kathy Hochul or Governor Cuomo this past year, but even more so, like, assembly members, you know, senators, whatever it was, they were all taking
teach
on.
Out.
Yes.
Very grassroots.
But, I mean, it's a nice way to kind of deal with the lack of, money that you may have regarding if, you have a good Republican candidate that's opposing you and whatnot. But I definitely think it has a lot to do with the grassroots and what we've been doing as far as approaching that.
Well, let me ask a business manager and treasurer for the Republicans at the University of Rochester. Scott, do you think money in politics is a problem?
I think money certainly does help with campaigns, but it isn't your entire campaign. If you don't have a good message, then you can buy those advertising spots, but it won't matter if people know that you don't have a good message.
Money can buy those votes.
Only to a certain point, I believe, though.
I think you're both right in the sense that Ross Perot spent a lot of money, and he did get a good percentage of the vote in 92 and 96, but he never got electoral votes. And so money can play a role if you don't have a good message. But if you're slick, your message is going to be nuanced by the kind of political management students we like to make at Nazareth College. So, you know.
But let's also point out, though, that even if you can raise money, you still have to win in Iowa, New Hampshire in the presidential process to have a shot. I think we can all agree that Rudy Giuliani would have received a lot more than zero delegates if the entire country had voted its primaries on the same day in 2008. He ends up waiting till Florida, trying to rally, and he went nowhere because he basically doesn't do anything in Iowa and New Hampshire, and he looks like a loser because for some reason the media buys this idea.
But
and Rudy Giuliani 1% of the country.
Yeah. He would have had a terribly difficult time making any kind of inroads in either one of those states.
But I'm not saying he should have won. I'm saying Rudy Giuliani would not have ended up with zero. And he ended up with zero because Iowa and New Hampshire set the stage.
So he's a better candidate because he made a really bad judgment call. I don't buy that at all. I think it actually showed a lack of judgment.
Evangelicals in Iowa were going nowhere.
I don't think that's the point that Evan's making.
No,
the point is that if you've got a candidate, and I think there are candidates who don't play well in those states, they just are not going to play well in that states. And a guy like Rudy Giuliani, I think, is a good example. This is a guy who's just not going to do real well in those states. And so he made what was I agree with you. At the end of the day, it was a fatal political judgment. But it wasn't an irrational decision to say, listen, I'm not going to have any traction. Instead of losing in Iowa, I'd rather not play in Iowa and then hope to be able to make some inroads later. I thought it was a political judgment that proved to have been false. But nonetheless, I mean, losing in Iowa is pretty bad, too.
But better to play by the rules that exist.
Not with evangelicals if you're Rudy Giuliani. They were not going to come.
Okay, but then evangelicals are not going to come
about
out
the
in
rules,
the general
Tim,
election.
About,
right, but again, in the general election, I mean, Republican candidates are helped tremendously by evangelical voters. I mean, frankly, one of the metrics to determine whether or not a person's likely to vote Republican or Democrat is whether they attend a house of worship on a weekly basis.
But, Scott, your party is not just about evangelical voters, and early in the Republican nominating process, that's who dominates. Fair?
Yeah, especially in Iowa, a very religious state. I believe it is fair to say that evangelicals and other religions do dominate the Republican process.
I'm getting way late for a break, and I do want to circle back to the policy side of things, but let me grab a phone call. And in fact, I should mention the phone number, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Keith, go ahead, Keith.
Gentlemen, interesting show. Personally, I just think the early primaries, such as Iowa and New Hampshire, just give a certain candidate bragging rights. If a particular candidate does win Iowa and then wins the presidency, you can't prove positive effect.
Keith, I feel like you are in an Iowa tornado, so do me a favor and find a way to call back when things calm down. Keith was saying, though, that all the early states really do is bragging rights. And I don't think, again, the numbers bear that out. I think the Iowa straw poll never does anybody any good. Nobody ever wins the straw poll ever wins.
No.
But winning the Iowa caucus and certainly winning New Hampshire It's been studied. Again, the number, look at the number that's studied. 1.6 of the American population is voting in that New Hampshire primary. Both sides combined, by the way. But you win the New Hampshire primary, and you are going to get a 27% boost in total delegates in the primary.
Right.
Process.
No one who comes
totally
in
disproportionate.
Below number two in Iowa or New Hampshire goes on to get the nomination. But again, we're talking about sample size. You mentioned Nate Silver. Nate Silver predicted the presidential outcome, not the candidate, but the presidential outcome, like 18 months before the election was even held. I mean, you know, so as a sample size, this might actually be not a bad metric to look at. And again, if
that's
you're concerned
bad statistics,
about that,
Tim, I'm sorry.
Well, if you look at sample size for Republicans, sample size for Democrats, not for the nation as a whole. Now, don't forget, New Hampshire's also got a lot of independents up there, and they're not as evangelical as Iowa. So then you've got to please some of the business community and the economic interests up in New Hampshire. And you're getting a lot of attention in New Hampshire and places like Boston. So I think that regionally, you've got some really interesting things going on here.
All right, we'll let our listeners decide who's drawn the most blood so far. And we're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk about whether we actually see this narrow focus on Iowa, New Hampshire bear out in actual policy. It's one thing to pander to voters in front of a crowd. It's another if policy and subsidies and tax dollars are flowing in certain directions. We're going to get into that in just a second with Kent Gardner, the chief economist for the Center for Governmental Research, Professor Tim Neeland, political science professor at Nazareth College, and chair of the Department of History and Political Science. Scott Onestak is the University of Rochester College Republicans treasurer and business manager. Iman Abid is the president of Monroe County Young Democrats. Short break. Join the conversation next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about the way women's roles have changed, especially in the last 50 or 60 years in this country. We'll talk to author Lily Capel, author of the book The Astronaut Wives Club, which is being developed into an ABC series. It looks at the wives of the Mercury 7 astronauts, and it looks at how their lives were thrust into the spotlight and how the role of women have changed since they were younger. Join the conversation next hour on Connections.
Legendary jazz singer Billie Holiday was born 100 years ago today. Her life was hard, and popular acclaim came only after she died.
Billie Holiday, you deserved so much more than you were given when you were on this planet. This is for you, Billie.
An appreciation later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. 2 months ago, Scott Walker, who is unofficially but really running for president, Wisconsin governor, and certainly one of the contenders in Iowa, announced the hiring of Liz Mayer. Now, you might not know the name Liz Mayer if you're not a political wonk, but Liz has been a longtime libertarian-leaning blogger, writer, and analyst. She worked for Rick Perry's campaign in a previous election. Scott Walker hired Liz Mayer to help in Iowa. Within 24 hours, the Des Moines Register had dug through Liz Mayer's Twitter feed, and they found a tweet that said this, quote, "The sooner we remove Iowa's front-running status, the better off American politics and policy will be." The Des Moines Register was aghast. They wanted to know, what do you mean by policy? And Liz Mayer responded very honestly. She said one word, ethanol. Within 24 hours, Scott Walker had fired her. That was the end of Liz Mayer Consulting on that campaign. Scott Walker could not afford to have someone on his staff who had said Iowa should not be going first. And Liz Mayer, in response, has said, "I don't work for him anymore, so I will now say I will stand by everything I wrote, and the policy is terrible." But Kent Gardner, you've looked at ethanol for a number of years. And in 2012, my understanding is the federal tax credit for ethanol ended. A lot of journalists have said, well, now we don't subsidize ethanol anymore. What's the reality?
Yeah, that's not true, because we still have the renewable fuel standard. The renewable fuel standard still mandates a certain mixing of ethanol with gasoline. You still go to the pump and you find that little sticker that says this is 10% ethanol, which I will point out reduces our gas mileage. So we're still spending money implicitly on subsidizing ethanol. It's still a stupid policy. It's a shame. Apparently, I suspect Liz Mayer will never actually work for a political campaign, at least until that campaign has passed Iowa. So maybe she can hope to get a job after the Iowa caucus has ended. And
very interestingly, Eric Erickson, who is one of the sort of evangelical Christian voices in the conversation. He defended Liz Mayer and said Scott Walker should stand up for her and talk about bad policy, and it is bad policy. But that is just anathema there.
It is, and it's, you know, as I said, the allusion to that old West Wing episode, it is absolutely critical. And it's critical for some significant reasons. Ethanol is very important to the Iowa economy. Ethanol is responsible for consuming a disproportionate amount of the total corn crop. I mean, 2011, the total corn crop was, 2.3 billion bushels. 1.3 billion bushels of that went into making ethanol, which, of course, is one of the reasons why corn prices are high, one of the reasons why beef prices are high. It's one of the reasons why tortilla prices are high, for heaven's sake. It's a terrible public policy.
And we have also seen 10 years ago in this state, Governor George Pataki was there rolling out the new plant. I think it's out of Medina, the Pembroke area. And he had talked at the time about the value of New York moving to more corn production, more ethanol production. It didn't take long for even Mother Jones. And if this is not just a right-wing attack on ethanol. Mother Jones is plenty left-leaning. Kevin Drum has attacked ethanol, called it catastrophically idiotic. And so, Kent, what you are telling us is, number one, we are still subsidizing it. And number two, it's bad for the environment, for those who said it would be better for the environment, because we know that crop rotation is important. Primary rotation is important. Crop rotation is important, too. And they don't rotate primaries. They don't rotate crops when there's ethanol subsidies. And
corn is particularly difficult. It's really tough on the land. And so if you've got monoculture corn, it is really, really hard on the soil. So that's one of the reasons why we rotate corn typically with alfalfa. Mm-hmm. Corn is it's a tough crop. And we're spending more gasoline growing the ethanol than we save by producing the ethanol. Now that's not to say that ethanol is not necessarily a promising fuel going forward. If you take a look at what Brazil does, for example, making ethanol from sugar byproducts, not even sugar and sugar byproducts. Arguably, ethanol produced in Brazil, makes economic sense, but not with corn.
But so corn-based ethanol, just about everybody who's doesn't have a dog in the fight is agreeing is a disaster.
Pretty much, left or right, doesn't matter.
Billions of dollars subsidies still happening every year. So, but Kent, you are taking the position that says it really does come down to the fact that if we rotated the primaries, the Iowa caucuses were not first, you think that could change?
We would have killed this thing ages ago. It's been a long, long time that a lot of sober voices have been saying, it is crazy to subsidize ethanol to this extent.
All right, Tim Nealon, you want to punch back on that at all?
I would just say there's a lot of congressional districts and a lot of Midwestern states where corn is grown in large numbers, and I don't see, as long as this subsidy is hitting. Now, again, it's going to hit agribusiness a great deal, but there's also some farmers out there still trying to cling on. As everyone knows, being a farmer in America is one of the toughest, least profitable employments in the United States. And the subsidy is helping. And I can't imagine the people in local congressional districts would be happy with any candidate who came out swinging against ethanol subsidies, even if you take Iowa off the plate. I don't know. Government policies have a way of maintaining long after their
They do have a zombie-like
sanity.
Quality. But
Tim, I think you do have to recognize that the concentration in Iowa is unusual. You're right. There are many other states where there's a lot of corn being produced. But take Illinois, for example. You mentioned Illinois. I'm sorry. Corn growers don't have a whole lot of influence in Illinois politics. You've got this city in Illinois called Chicago.
But you have congressional districts in southern Illinois.
There are congressional districts, but it's still it's a hypothetical with that.
Okay. All right. I will grant you that. Yes. That if Iowa, then I would be interested to see. But I also cynically, there I'm picking up some of Evan's cynicism, I don't think that would go away.
And by the way, I've said on this program, cynicism is not a positive force. I don't mean to be cynical. It's just frustrating to look at the system sometimes. Before I get back to the phones, Paul, some others were coming to you. Kent, any other ag policy that you see impacted by this process?
Well, I think ag policy has always been highly political. And so, you know, it's not just corn. There are other ag policies. I mean, the whole program of subsidizing field crops. The field crops have long been heavily subsidized. The way we, how we handle exports of field crops, I mean, all of those policies are influenced by the political process, and so there certainly is an extent to which Iowa's own interests in the farm bill are disproportionately represented because of this system. I mean, that's not the only reason. There are a lot of, you know, farms are, you know, ag policy has always been disproportionately influential in Washington. And that's way out of proportion to the actual income we derive from farming. And we still think of ourselves as a nation of gentlemen farmers, and it's so far from the truth. I mean, so much of total crop acreage is concentrated in a very small number of owners. You know, the small family farm, that's the image that we bring up, but the small family farm is to a large extent gone in America. Most of agriculture is dominated by corporate farms, very large sole proprietors. You know, ag policy, you know, really has a disproportionate sway on the political process in general. It's not just because of Iowa,
right.
But Iowa helps.
Oh, sure. And it's been that way, though, since the 19th century.
Since
you know, we
Thomas
talk about,
Jefferson.
What right, well, to, but even, you know, when you think about the cabinet, we have these cabinets that are basically created for different constituent groups, and agriculture was one of the first ones. I mean, think about, you know, the comparison between something like defense, which is, you know.
The fact that it's historic doesn't make it a good idea.
No, but it also, it makes it, no, but I'm saying it's, I don't, again, that's why Iowa only becomes really significant after 1976, and I understand the argument about ethanol, but I think agriculture is going to remain a dominant interest clique in American politics.
No disagreement.
All right, Paul in Rochester. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, good afternoon. Great panel, great conversation and subject. This is mostly directed for the young lady who's in charge of the young voters. With
Iman Abid's here. Iman is the president of Monroe County Young Democrats.
Yes. Or actually any other one of the panels. This is a type of subject and debate that could actually go national. If someone on your panel could maybe start a campaign on a national basis to find out would more Americans like to see this happen rather than just having this subject in Rochester, pass it all across the United States.
I didn't follow. More Americans like to see what happened, Paul?
The change of the change, in other words, move from Iowa and New Hampshire around the country. Get the opinion of the general populace.
Yeah. Paul, thanks. He just wants to check in with what Iman and Scott think. And for those who haven't maybe been listening the entire hour, we've been talking about the possibility of rotating the system. You're wrapped up in so many other things, you both are, but if this process changed, what would you do differently? What would Monroe County Young Democrats do if the process saw New York earlier in the presidential primary system?
Well, I mean, then it would just start directing towards more candidates who are far more well-established, well-organized, well-financed, and just kind of be able to support those sort of candidates. And as you were mentioning earlier, Neil, Kent. You were saying that, you know, in Iowa, we're serving the purposes of, you know, we're behind ethanol. But in essence, we're no longer serving those farmers that we once thought were behind the American, you know, trademark. But now we're serving these corporates. So that's a little dark little thing that you found like a little loophole. And in essence, if Iowa is playing out that huge influence in what every other state is going to shape out to be, then what are we serving in the very end? You know, we're not serving the constituent. We are now serving the corporate these corporate entities. And so, like, I think if it were to start change, I think we would start refocusing. But in itself, I almost find that quite dangerous. I think already what we have on our plate is dangerous to begin with. And with millennials, as Evan, as cynical as you may be, I think millennials are also quite cynical as well.
You know, this may surprise you and our listeners today. I'm actually quite sanguine about this country and many, many other things. I'm just more... I don't even think I'm cynical. I think I'm just trying to be realistic. I think I'm trying to look at the process and connect dots here.
And I think that's, especially behind the efforts that I have behind the Young Democrats, what we're trying to do is honestly raise these questions, but also find the solutions to what we already have. I mean, already enough people are already trying to fight the institution. And you can't fight the institution if you want to change it. So to begin changing it, you have to start understanding and adapting to it. But it doesn't mean submitting yourself and sacrificing anything that you may have. And it's very tough trying to tell young, passionate people who have these great, you know, they have they're behind such great causes, and they come from different parts and different backgrounds and whatnot. But it's time to honestly take a step back, understand what there is in front of us, and go from there. But
Iman, when we look at the processes, we've talked about this hour, there are certain candidates who can't really get through Iowa and New Hampshire the way they want to. Their candidacy may be over. In your party on the Democratic side, you know, you may have a hard time having anybody really challenge Hillary Clinton in this cycle. But if Elizabeth Warren got into it, if there were a move to get someone who's to the left of Hillary, which I think some Democrats are clamoring for,
yes,
could they get through the first couple of states? Are you concerned, again, about the disproportionate sway without a truly national contest for opening up that kind of a fight?
Yes, that in itself, the idea of it is quite scary, to be honest, because it's just not what traditional politics was supposed to be in the very beginning. But I mean, that is what it is today. And unfortunately, that's where it comes in with the money and the influence and your ability to kind of grab those ethanol lobbyists, let's say, you know, that's going to play a heavy influence. But my biggest concern is, in all honesty, just trying to find a candidate that actually serves the constituent and, you know, has a direct representative. And I think, yes, Elizabeth Warren does do that very well. Mm. Is she quite as influential as Hillary Clinton, maybe? Absolutely not. I don't think that, you know, that she could stand a chance, in all honesty. I do like her, but to fight this political process, I just don't think she'd be able to make it past those two states. And that's where the problem starts to come out.
Although I will put a plug in for Iowa. They are actually very progressive in Iowa, in places like Davenport. Tom Harkin was not exactly a shrinking wallflower when it came to progressive ideals. And I think Elizabeth Warren would actually do very well in Iowa with retail politics 101. And New Hampshire's right next door to Massachusetts. Right. So I think she would actually have quite a boost.
But the troubling thing is, whether you're Rudy Giuliani or John Huntsman or Elizabeth Warren or anybody else, if you don't perform in those first two tiny, non-diverse states, you're basically done. That is part of the issue. If those first two tiny, non-diverse states at least shifted and they went last sometimes, well, then maybe I think there would be a feeling of more fairness. Scott, where am I going wrong?
I kind of feel like, if you look at the Republican Party, there's the very conservative, sort of the middle of the road, and then the moderates. And I feel like if you broke the states up into like the three subdivisions and then said, okay, we're going to choose one at random from each of these three groups and have you go on the same day for our first primary, then the first state, you might get three different winners in each state. So the first state wouldn't have as much influence as I would have on New Hampshire and New Hampshire on the rest of the states. And therefore, you may be able to get diversity opinions and not get this snowballing, self-fulfilling prophecy effect.
I think that's exactly right, Tim. And so before we even close the hour, let's make sure we do understand. We've talked a little bit about the proposals to rotate it, to create the kind of system that Scott's talking about. Realistically, is anything going to happen, or could it happen, Tim?
No, because I don't think the major political parties are invested in making the changes. As I said, the Republicans in 2000 suggested something called the American Plan, which had this idea of smaller states up through four cycles and then rotating through bigger, smaller states throughout up to 10 different cycles every 2 weeks of having these candidates. But it was killed by the Republican National Committee, who feared that the Democrats would not follow suit, and they do not want a prolonged campaign. People do not like to have these long campaigns
That's
going up to
point.
June.
Yes.
Rather than this year, the Republicans are meeting in July. They would like to have a candidate in place, I'm sure, by March, so that they can begin to reintroduce this person on the national
stage.
So
for all the talk about a competitive primary vets the candidate, helps, these parties really would like to line things up.
Well, yeah, but that's why they like Iowa and New Hampshire, because they do vet the candidates. If you're going to say something stupid about ethanol or decide you're going to try to circumvent
the games. Who says
it's
stupid?
You know, well, it
Who
is.
Who determines what's stupid about ethanol?
One can be very diplomatic, but to say the word moron, like Liz Mayer did, that's not diplomatic. That sounds like a blogger, not like a political consultant. And that is egregious. You don't want to insult anyone in the political process. We can have a debate. We can have a discussion. Kent and I disagree. We're not calling each other names.
Yeah, she didn't have to call anybody a moron, though, to get bumped from, to get bounced off of Walker's campaign, I suspect. All she had to do was to breathe that she wasn't supportive of ethanol, and she was toast.
That's
quite possible.
But Tim's point is the long buildup, even the long buildup, the media buildup, the debates just for Iowa and New Hampshire, Tim's point is that he thinks at least that puts the national spotlight on the backgrounds of the candidate that helps vet them in an effective way.
Very quite effective. So that by the time we get to Iowa or New Hampshire, you know if someone You know, an outside candidate has some sort of weird arrangement where they're paying for housing for young women, as happened 4 years ago, right? We have this, you know, these candidates look really good, but they do get vetted long before they get. We haven't even started the primary cycle yet. This summer and fall, we'll have debates. We'll have Republican debates and Democratic debates. That the national scheme will get a chance to look at these people debating each other long before Iowa and New Hampshire. So I think it does. We do get a chance to vet them before they show up in our states.
Well, let me close on first a cynical.
But they never show up in our states.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, in case, you know, the vice presidential candidate
but,
might, but New York could go earlier.
Let me close first on a cynical note. I think it's illegal to put solar panels on your roof in Iowa. I don't think it's actually illegal, but
probably.
But a more sanguine note, you meet people like Scott and Iman, and what the nice thing is, yes, we are essentially left out of the presidential primary process. But Scott and Iman are involved in campaigns in different ways. And to some degree, to our own detriment, the media does focus on the presidential race without letting people know that getting involved on a grassroots level, a local level, in many ways are so important. And Iman and Scott are doing that. At the very least, they're not saying we're sitting out just because the presidential candidates don't come here. So, hey, guys, thank you both for doing that. And that's an optimistic note. We can close there, right?
Yeah.
Iman with Young Democrats, Scott, the campus Republicans at the University of Rochester, Kent Gardner with CGR. That was fun.
Thanks, Evan. Always fun to be here.
Tim Neeland with Nazareth. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Evan.
Always great fun. Short break. We're right back on Connections.